Warning, the Stone Age Gamer includes a lot of bad language. Cover your mother f***ing ears.
Good evening and welcome to episode 187 of the Stone Age Gamer podcast for the week of February 2nd, 2018. I am Chris Randazzo and joining me tonight is author of no books, Dan Ryan.
I've written a few. They're self-published. You wouldn't understand them.
Of course not.
They're very deep.
And joining us, special guest tonight, author of several books, special guest Brett Weiss.
Hey guys, how's it going?
It's pretty good. Did I pronounce your last name right?
You did. Absolutely. Awesome. What's interesting is these days most people pronounce it right, Weiss, which is the correct pronouncement, but back in the day, or pronunciation I should say, back in the day in the 80s, I got called Weiss constantly. I don't know what's changed, if there's just more Weisses in the country now or what, but yeah, you got it right.
People have gotten Weisser.
That's why I came on for the show.
I mean, there was a very famous baseball player in the 80s.
Walt Weiss.
Walt Weiss. Yeah. Like.
And then there was Janet Weiss from the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
You would think that they would put two and two together and get my name right.
You would think so.
You would think. Yeah.
Way to go, America.
Good job. Down.
Well, at least they do it now. So.
Brett is here to kick off Creators Month here at the Stone Age Gamer Podcast. Before we go any further and explain to you what that is, here's your weekly reminder that you can email us at mail@geekade.com. Just include the word Stone Age Gamer in the subject line. You can let us know what you think of our show, what topics you would like us to discuss in the future, or just say hello, because we always want to hear from you, the listener. So, as I mentioned mere seconds ago, Dan and I decided to make February Creators Month here at the Stone Age Gamer Podcast. All month long, we'll be interviewing some of our favorite video game adjacent creators. That's not necessarily people who make games, but people who make things about games. And this week, we are joined by author Brett Weiss. He's got several books behind him and at least one book ahead of him that actually features words written by Dan and myself. So, Brett, welcome to the show.
The best words.
I'm honored to be here. Thanks, guys.
Why don't you tell us all a little bit about your work and yourself?
Well, I'm a fossil. I turned 50 last year, so I date back all the way to almost the very beginning of video games, pretty much. So I started gaming in 75, 76, hitting up the arcades when, you know, electrochemical machines were still in most of the arcades. Those old driving games that had the big wheel and the panel that would move back and forth and a beam of light to show your car.
I used to love those things. They had one of those, this campground that I went to when I was a kid, and they had all these other awesome arcade games, which I loved. That's mm-hmm. the first place I saw.
Oh, Punch Out, Gauntlet. Because they're so physical.
Yeah, they're super cool. Never seen
baseball
one since.
Games where you turn the handle and there's a bat that's, you know, hit the ball
awesome.
Up into little holes in the outfield, you know, that kind of stuff. But there was also Pong and in 75, I remember when like Midway's Gunfight and games like that started showing up. And then when Breakout hit, and I was a pinball fanatic. My brother and I were both just absolutely, you know, into pinball. But then in 76, when Breakout hit my local arcade, that's when I started to realize I might like video games even more than pinball. And so my brother and I would, at this point, we'd become basically pinball wizards, pinball sharks, and we would play games and figure out which games we could master, and we would pop a bunch of games. Like there was Dolly Parton, Firepower, and Hot Hand that we would just absolutely master, and we would pop a bunch of games on those and sell our extra games for quarters to go play video games. So, grew up in the arcades,
awesome.
And it was a lot of fun. My brother and I didn't have a lot of money. I mean, we had a nice house, food, cars, and all that good stuff, but we didn't have, my parents were pretty tight with the purse strings, so we had to earn allowance and, you know, just scrape by on whatever we could get. And so we learned early on that, you know, to search at the arcade, you know, to search the coin slots for tokens and to, you know, somebody would be playing pinball, and if you could tell they were just kind of a noob or if they were a parent or something, they would just walk away when the game was over. Well, we'd stand around and wait to see if that game would pop, because they would just walk off. You know, we'd had a 10% chance of the game matching, you know, and we'd get a free game of pinball that way. So we'd hang around the arcade for 4 or 5 hours, you know, and only bring 50 cents with us, you know, and play all day. So a lot of arcades, a lot of console gaming. A lot of my friends had, my two best friends in 1976, each had a Fairchild Channel F, which was pretty mind-blowing at the time. Yeah. And, yeah, my next-door neighbor and then a friend down the street, they just happened to be my best friends, and they just happened to each have a Fairchild Channel F. So when they got those, I was, you know, mine was blown. And as everybody knows, those came out, you know, a year before the 2600. And
I don't think I've ever known anybody outside of myself and Leonard Herman that actually have a Fairchild Channel F. And you knew two people with one. Like,
nowadays you can find hardcore collectors, you know, completists with them and stuff. But back in the day, you were definitely more likely, you know, in 76, you might have friends with like a Pong clone or Pong, or maybe the original Magnavox Odyssey. But to find someone with a Fairchild Channel F was pretty unusual. But then in 77, all my friends started getting Ataris, and then up through 79 and 80 in televisions and Odyssey 2s. And I was very jealous, but I would, you know, go over to their houses and play the heck of it out of them. I would have been, you know, I turned 10 in 77, so I was prime for some Atari 2600. It was just way, you know, 2600 was $250 when it came out originally in stores, and that was just, you know, way more than my parents were going to be willing to spend even during Christmas. So I was a nuisance at a lot of people's homes that had Atari 2600 going over there to play and stuff. So,
I mean, well, I grew up especially in Texas. You said in 77, $250 in 1977 is very different amount than it is today.
Absolutely.
That is maybe a staggering difference.
Yeah, like $700 or $800 or something insane like that. Just,
yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, you think video games are expensive now. They were way more expensive back then. You know, Atari 2600 cartridges, $30 to $45 a piece.
That's
1977, $1978, which is crazy. I remember seeing Asteroids for sale at the store for like $46.99 at, you know, Service Merchandise or Best or Kmart, you know, stores like that, and just nuts.
I love Asteroids. That 2600 was what I started on. I got a 2600 Junior was my first game console, and
very cool.
That was in, let's see, I don't even remember what year it was. It wasn't that long after the Junior came out. I think I'm pretty sure NES was already out in stores when I got mine, and I was obsessed with it. I loved it. Before that, I had always wanted to go over my my cousin's house. They had an Atari, and like, I would go upstairs and play Atari, and everyone else would be out like swimming in the pool, and I'd be like, yeah, screw you guys, I'm playing Mega Mania.
I'm sitting inside. I'm an indoor kid,
very much so.
Right. I had a ColecoVision was my first system, and I played the hell out of Smurfs and Mousetrap.
And how old were you at that point?
Oh, God. When I had the ColecoVision, I remember having it in kindergarten. So five, you know, four or five, something like that.
And that would have been, did you early get eight, pretty much eight, right after it came out?
Yeah, it was like 85, 86, somewhere around there.
Okay, so you got it after started to be closed out.
I might have had it before then. I don't really remember. I remember playing that when it was in the living room of my house. I didn't have a TV in my bedroom at that point, which I know for younger listeners of the show, like, that seems, you didn't have a screen whenever you wanted it. Like, how God, what type of Stone Age life? Yeah, what Stone Age life did you live? But yeah, like, I would go into the living room. My mom and I just lived in this like little two bedroom apartment, and I would always bug her to play like Mousetrap with a little insert to slide into the ColecoVision on the keypad controller.
And looking at your controller to figure out which color code.
Yeah, it was so cool. I loved it. Yeah,
excellent port. Just about perfect. They had Mousetrap at my local arcade back in the day, and man, when the ColecoVision port came out, I was just amazed. As a matter of fact, when I got my ColecoVision, it was Christmas of 1982, and I had to pay for half of it. I mean, it was, ColecoVisions were about $200 with tax and everything. It was like, I remember it being $189.99, and with tax and everything, it would have been about $205, and our Christmases were only $100. I say only, I mean, you know, kids starving in Africa and all, but
right,
you know, but
first world problems, but
yeah, exactly. But, you know, a ColecoVision wasn't going to happen for Christmas because it was too expensive, but I mowed lawns that summer. I was 15 and kicked in $100 plus $30 for Mousetrap. So when I got my ColecoVision, it was right after it had come out. It came out, you know, I remember seeing the commercials in the summer of 82 and knowing I just had to get one because of the Donkey Kong screenshots just looking so perfect. And so for Christmas, I got the ColecoVision with the Donkey Kong pack in and then the mousetrap added to it. And man, I was just amazed by, as great as Donkey Kong is, mousetrap is even better as far as arcade port. I mean, it's just about perfect.
I loved this game. I mean, just played the hell out of this. This and Smurfs. That was it.
Well, Smurfs,
I had a bunch of other ones. These were the two mm-hmm. I played.
Well, Smurf Rescue in Gargamel's Castle. I mean, that was, you know, that was one of the real early platformers, you know, that and Pitfall and a few others, you know, paved the way for Super Mario Brothers and everything. And, you know, you hear Smurf and you're like, hi, whatever. But, you know, it was amazing at the time. Cartoon like graphics and, you know, this gameplay mechanic, you just didn't have that much. Walking to the right and jumping over stuff was really mind-blowing, you know, in 1982.
Oh, and it looked so amazing. Like, and I go back and look at it now, like, I've shown it to my kids, you know, like, through an emulator, and they're like, what the fuck is this? And we don't let them curse that often, but that time I felt like it was warranted.
I mean, all things considered, it animates pretty darn well too. Like the Smurf game. I didn't have a lot of, still to this day, I don't have a ton of experience with ColecoVision. I have one in a bunch of games, but I was such an Atari kid that nothing, you know, anytime anybody mentioned ColecoVision or Intellivision to me, I wasn't really like, all right, whatever, I have an Atari and this is the best thing ever because this is the one that I have. It wasn't until my friend Joey DeBono got an NES and I played that for the first time where things really changed for me because I also didn't have a lot of arcade experience at that point either. So my learning about games and especially arcade ports and stuff is kind of goes backwards. Like I'd play the Atari games first and be like, oh, so this is what Pac-Man's supposed to look like. That's crazy. And that was my first experience with Pac-Man was 2600. So I didn't see a problem with it. You know, like I had nothing to go on. Game plays fine. So I was, I loved Pac-Man, but man, when I saw the arcade one, I'm like, whoa, he goes up, like he faces up. That's so crazy.
And there's color.
All the different ghosts are different colors and not blinking constantly. This is crazy.
Well, the thing about Pac-Man, you know, as bad of a port it is, it's very playable, and I still break it out every once in a while. Just, you know, it's still a challenging to score a few thousand points. You know, it's still fun to me.
I love the sounds in that game too. Like,
hung.
This is the weird little gang, 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 gang. It's so crazy, and I always like remember getting the one big square dot in the middle with the yellow thing. Looked like a delicious candy of some kind, and. It's supposed to be a fruit or whatever. This is supposed to be something. I don't know.
Yeah.
And there was always that one dot towards the middle that was like two dots squished together. And I always felt it was super cool when you got that. That was neat because all the dots were bars in that for some reason. Loved the box art on that one too.
Yeah, great box art. And, you know, as vilified as that game is, back then, kids loved it regardless of what it, you know, I mean, I talked to tons of gamers from the time and at the time, you know, that just played it for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah, I'm one of them. I loved that game. Of course, I also really got a lot of playtime out of E.T. too, which is the other one that gets like all the crap on it in the world. But it's like, yeah, there's worse games on the Atari than E.T. Like that game's got problems. It's frustrating as hell with the falling into pits. But my sister and I would usually just, we'd put it on the difficulty where there were no dudes chasing after you. So it was like ludicrously easy, but it was still just kind of fun to wander around and make
you. Did you read the manual? Did you read the manual before you
absolutely.
Played? Okay. Cause people who back in the day who actually took the time to read the manual and figure out what you're supposed to do, you know, tended to like it or at least tolerate it as opposed to if you just tried to pick up and play, it's pretty much no go.
Yeah, it's pretty obtuse. It's kind of hard to figure out what you're supposed to do. But I loved manuals. I always read the manuals back in the day because they were so interesting. Like they were just neat to kind of see. I've talked about this on our show before. One of the reasons I love the Atari so much is looking at the instructions, reading the instructions, and looking at the artwork on the cover of the box, and then using my imagination to kind of fill in the gaps between that artwork and the rudimentary graphics in the Atari. It's like. There's so much imagination involved in that, and I don't mean that disparagingly. Like,
you're absolutely right.
Limitations are what they are, but you know, when I played Adventure, I'm imagining the dragons looking like the dragon on the cover of the box, you know. And I got Tim Lapatino's Art of Atari poster book. I got five of those framed up on my wall right now because I love that artwork so much.
Yeah, I was going to say that he really, with the original Art of Atari book, he really captured the essence of what's so great about Atari art and how it transfers to the actual games themselves in your imagination and everything, like you say. And then I haven't picked up the poster book yet, but yeah.
It's great that if you can spare the cash and you have the wall space, get two of them because they're double-sided, so... Yeah, you always have to choose, like, do I want this one or this one? Fortunately, I had
that Sophie's choice with each page turn. That's very stressful.
You really did. I wound up going with, I put five of them up. I've got, if I sound weird, I'm looking behind me. It's Star Raiders, Video Pinball, Missile Command, Millipede, and Asteroids were the five that I went with.
Good choices.
I love the Video Pinball cover. It's like one of my favorites ever. Oh, and I also, he has poster size of that one Atari ad that has the wizard and the basketball player and the chess on the bottom.
I have
that one framed above the computer too, because that was awesome.
Very cool. I remember the Atari basketball box having like white guys all over it, and I was like, okay, what's going on?
with big curly hair and mustaches, yeah.
Right, yeah. Porn stash.
Good old porn stashes of the 80s.
Right.
Gotta love them.
70s too.
Yeah, 70s and 80s. Yeah, sorry. I was born in 81, so I always, that whole era, as much as I'm fascinated by it, and you know, we had very little money when we were kids, so I got into more modern stuff later. So as much as I love that stuff, it associates more 80s to me than 70s, because, you know, I wasn't there.
Right, sure.
Because wasn't there. I did not exist.
Well, I was lucky with my Atari 2600. You know, I got the ColecoVision in 82. Well, not long after that, a kid at school, I mean, once back, okay, now it's cool to have several systems and to be retro and all that. But, you know, and back then, you know, suddenly when the ColecoVision and Atari 5200 came out, you were suddenly uncool if you still played in television or Atari or Odyssey 2. And so this kid at school had gotten a ColecoVision. That was a huge craze at our school, the ColecoVision. Everybody got one, it seemed like. And this one kid, as soon as he got his, you know, he didn't want to touch his Atari 2600 ever again. And so I bought it from him for $10 with 10 games, all the hookups and everything. And this was like in 83, so it was a great deal.
Yeah,
but he just didn't want it. So that started my path of buying pretty much every system that ever existed in a turn, you know, forever. And so,
got the beginning of the end, as it were.
Absolutely. Yeah. So got the Intellivision not long after that. And then when the NES came out, I got my NES. I've always thought it was 86, but I was looking at some old photos not long ago, and it was actually the Christmas of 87 is when I got my NES. You know, those memories get a little fuzzy going back that far. Yeah, absolutely. But I was 20 at that point, you know, so I was, you know, supposed to be fairly jaded and everything. But when I started playing Super Mario Brothers, it just knocked me out because, I mean, not just the graphics and the secrets and surprises and the cartoon, you know, look of the game and all that, but just the control, just the freedom of movement that your character had and the precision of the controller and just the way he moved and you know, that was... Every controller before the NES had a fairly significant problem to it. I mean, I like some of them. I like the 2600 joystick. I'm one of the only people I know that really likes the ColecoVision controller a lot, but they all had some issue. Well, the NES controller, at least at the time when it came out, was just about ideal. You know, really not much to complain about there. So as much as anything, I think the NES made an advance with the controllers. Of course, those were using designs from the old Game & Watch, but... But just console-wise, those controls were a major milestone.
Yeah, it was taking all those different pieces of Game & Watch controls and putting them together in one little thing on a wire that was just the perfect size, perfect shape. It was, you're absolutely right. It was perfect. So I remember playing Super Mario Brothers for the first time and getting that controller in my hand using the D-pad. I had never heard of a Game & Watch before, so my experience was all with the Atari 2600 joystick and just being blown away by the buttons. And you're right, the movement of them. Because you think about how, like, like Pitfall Harry moves and jumps. And that was pretty much the bulk of my platforming experience at the time. You compare that to the way Mario moves and jumps, and it's night and day. It's a totally different thing. And plus,
yeah, I think more than the graphics or the secrets or surprises, I think the controls just really, really knocked it, you know, really were the biggest difference. Maybe not the most obvious difference right away, but the controls were just really excellent.
It was that, and it was that combined. Honestly, it was the music was a huge thing for me too.
Yeah, that's it. Absolutely.
Not a lot of music in Atari games, and
it didn't just keep looping like some of the old games. You got some different songs and stuff. So absolutely, yeah. Speaking of Game & Watch, I have a ridiculous story that almost seems like a nightmare about the old Game & Watch. If you got a second to hear what it is.
We got all night, man.
Yeah. So, a few years ago, over a decade ago, I don't remember when it was. I've tried to block it out of my memory, but here I am talking about it again. This was years and years ago. Around the time when GameStop, Funko Land started transforming to GameStop and all that.
Dan and I both worked for that company. I was there for the transition. It was a nightmare.
At one point, GameStop got in stacks and stacks of these little boxed, rectangular, handheld-looking thingies. Well, at the time, I mean, I've always been a console guy. I've always been an arcade guy. And I had the old Mattel electronic handhelds and all that. I wasn't familiar with the Game & Watches at the time. And when I saw them, they had stacks of them at this GameStop that they were blowing out for $1.99 each. And this sounds made up. This sounds crazy. But I guess it was a warehouse find or something. And there were just stacks of them. And I thought, well, these look interesting. I just assumed there were some kind of little novelty repro, or not even a repro, but just, you know, just some little gadget, you know, like you see all the time at Spencer's, keychains, little blister packs, you know, all these little things. I didn't even hardly pay them any attention. So I grabbed a few just because they were cool looking, and I thought, okay, well, I'll get a couple of these of each. There was a gambling one, a Donkey Kong Jr., and a Donkey Kong. And so I grabbed two of each, brought them home. And I thought, this was when eBay was new, and I thought, and I wasn't really used to looking up completed auctions or anything like that. I just threw one of each on eBay. I thought, well, this will go more than $1.99, and I kept a couple for myself, and well, as soon as, after a couple of days, I checked my auctions, like, holy cow, these things are going insane. I don't remember what year this was. Maybe early 2000s or something like that, or late 1990s or whatever. But whatever it was
early 2000s. It was early still 2000s, Funko when sense. Dreamcast launched. So GameStop buyout was not long after that, I don't think.
Okay, yeah, early 2000s then, and when Game & Watches started becoming valuable. And I was, at this point, I can't believe I didn't really recognize these right away, because I'm really, you know, follow the history of gaming and all that. Just the Game & Watches weren't on my radar. And
really, how often do you see those? I mean,
yeah, I never saw them in the wild and
in the box like that.
Yeah, and
like,
my friends didn't have them, and they weren't. I collected video game books. They weren't in any of the books I had, you know. And I wasn't searching the web for tons of gaming stuff at that point. I mean, I had the books and the games themselves, and friends, and would go over, you know, to play all their systems and whatnot. But I just wasn't familiar with the Game & Watches, and so I went home and. You know, those, I'd put them on eBay, and after a couple of days, they just started skyrocketing. I was like, holy cow. So I rushed back to that GameStop. Please, 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 still be there. And I get there, and that whole shelf, of course, is just completely barren. Someone in the know, a reseller or just a collector, somebody that knows what they were doing. I mean, even the employees didn't know what they were doing, obviously, because they were put out on the shelves, and that space was just empty. And I calculated it in my head that I had screwed myself out of probably about $6,000 or $7,000 worth of Game & Watches.
Wow.
Just because I didn't know what I was doing at that point. Really sucked. I was like miserable for about 4 days till my wife was about to kill me just to get over it. But that sounds crazy. But those warehouse finds would show up back then. You know, in the 1990s and early 2000s, you would have warehouse finds show up in stores. And most of us that were collecting at the time would buy one, you know, whatever we saw, because we wanted it for our collection. and then not knowing at the time the stuff was valuable or the stuff would get valuable later, you know. And yeah, that even harkens back to the old video game crash of 83, yeah. when all those tubs of, or those big displays of, you know, Atari 2600 games starting off at $9.99, down to $5, down to $3, down to
$1. Yeah, that's how I got my copy of Dig Dug. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We're going into an old Best that was closing. It was a Bradley's that was closing down. I picked up like five or six Atari games for like $1 a piece. But
you know, and everybody at the time would get one because they wanted it for their collection. It never occurred to any, to almost anyone to get more than one. Because why would you need more than one? You know,
I'm not going to resell this ever. Like,
yeah,
eBay really ruined a lot of this for everybody. I mean, it really did, though. Like, you know, all this stuff, you know, I look like I had growing up, I was the only kid in my neighborhood that had a TurboGrafx-16. And for whatever reason, there was a video game store in Turnersville, New Jersey, inside the Amish Farmers Market. Right. So it's only open on the weekends. And, you know, I it was called Bandit Video. I think it's actually still there. Bandit Video Games might still be there. Anyway, doesn't matter. Decided I had wanted something else and took in my TurboGrafx, you know, traded it in, got whatever the other stuff was that I wanted. Years later, went to look up, you know, I'd like to get my TurboGrafx back. I'd like to play Splatterhouse and, you know, Keith Courage and Alpha Zone.
Blazing Lasers
and Legendary Axe and like all these awesome games. Like when I was like, I'm going to hop onto eBay, see how much one of these things is. Like, fuck, I'm not paying $200 for that. Right. That's insane. Yeah. No way. This dude gave me like nuts. $20 for the game, for the console and all the games I had. I was like, it's just crazy. Like, it just made this stuff just so exorbitantly priced that collecting has become competitive and difficult. And that's a shame.
And it really... You know, 20 years ago with eBay and everything, it really started taking up. But then 10 years ago with Angry Video Game Nerd and all the YouTube reviewers and everything, it even and with the Wii Shop channel making retro gaming more popular and, you know, things like that. Retro gaming, you know, just gotten more and more popular, driving prices more, you know, higher and higher, which is, you know, good and bad. You know, just depending on how you look at it. It's bad if you're trying to amass a bunch of games of the original, you know, box and manual and all that, but it's good for overall for the just retro gaming in general, I think.
Well, to kind of match up with your story of the Game & Watches, and all of my time, we never really saw those kinds of warehouse finds in our area, at least in any
where would that have been?
Well, I was working in the Maze Landing Funko Land, which then became the Maze Landing GameStop, and then Maze Landing, New Jersey, so South Jersey. Not a lot of warehouse finds around there, but I did eventually move to New York, and I worked at a Toys R Us in College Point in Queens, which I just found out today is closing. So hooray! I hate that place.
The one in Queens is closing.
Yeah, the one in Queens is closing.
And Maze Landing Queens and Yonkers are closing, right?
Yeah, I think so.
That sucks.
I'm working out at this Toys R Us, and it's when Game Boy Advance is kind of, you know, taken off and whatnot, and it really had already taken off for the most part, and we're downsizing our Game Boy Color section, and we had three different games in stock for Game Boy Color. We had these two different ET games. It was like one was like a pocket planner or whatever.
I remember those, right?
Those, and then the third game that we had like 50 copies of for $5 a piece was a game called Shantae. And I didn't buy a single one because I looked at it and said, oh, this game looks dumb. That is like a sealed copy of Shantae is like $500-$600 now.
Wow, Shantae.
And I could have bought those.
That one doesn't even ring a bell with me, Shantae.
It's like one of WayForward's first games. It was published by Capcom. They've made a handful of other Shantae games since. They even re-released the original Game Boy Color one on 3DS Virtual Console. But yeah, it's just this ridiculously expensive Game Boy Color game, and I could have bought a stack of them for nothing.
And you didn't buy one.
Not a single copy of it. Just don't need that. Guy, I've talked about how many times I've passed up Earthbound back when I was working at Funko Land. People trading that thing and like, I'll get it eventually. It's a first party Nintendo title. Those things never go away.
Right.
Never.
Well, it's funny. There's warehouse finds and there's also just store closeouts, you know, just getting rid of stuff. I remember Toys R Us having stacks and stacks of boxed 32 X's for $9.99 each at the tail end of its life.
Yep, the Pikachu N64s. Add them at $10 a piece at my mm-hmm. local Toys R Us. I didn't buy one of them because I was like, those things are just so ugly. Man.
I think that's how I got my copy of Psychonauts. I think I bought Psychonauts for like $5, like mm-hmm. just in a Toys R Us bargain bin.
And that's nice.
It's beautiful, but it's a shame that game
went
that direction.
Oh, God damn it.
And GameStop had stacks and stacks of Conker's Bad Fur Day for $9.99. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember that.
Yeah, and
that.
I bought my one copy, at least I got one.
But, same here. I bought mine when it first came out. But I contemplated buying another one, and now I've wondered, I don't know where my box and manual for that went. So I just have the cart on that game. It's heartbreaking to me.
Yeah, but, no doubt. I made a horrible decision. Go ahead.
I was going to say, speaking of box and manuals, when you're talking about store closeouts, that was similar to how I got a lot of my box and manuals. I have two giant boxes filled with flattened game boxes and another couple of boxes of manuals because, Funko Land used to display the boxes up there and then have drawers behind the counter of all the manuals. Mm-hmm. And then at a certain point, they'd stop, like they say, all right, well, we're not dedicating wall space to NES games anymore or Game Gear games or Super NES or Game Boy. And they say they told all of the stores in my district to throw out all the boxes. And I immediately called every store in the district and said, don't throw them out. Put them in a box. I will drive to you and pick them up.
Nice.
So I have tons of boxes for all these games. Like I have extra boxes for like Mario RPG and the Final Fantasy Game Boy games and whatnot. Like just a bunch of that stuff that I've held on to for years because I was very happy that
thrown away. That's good that you saved that. Very preservationist of the decade right there. Well, I made the horrible decision sometime around 88 or 89 I was still living at home. I was 21 or so. And I was going to school and working and doing all this stuff. But my parents were super chill and I didn't have any big rush to move out yet. And so I had my room and everything, and I was thinking, these 80-plus boxed with manual ColecoVision games sure are taking up a lot of room. I think I will keep the manuals, put them in a drawer, and I've got my, cartridges in those old faux wooden, wood grain little cases.
I love those.
Yeah.
I wish I still had mine.
I did have... I had a few of those in that, but then I had, all the boxes just lined up on these shelves. And I had probably four or five ColecoVision games that I had found at garage sales, that were just card only and had with my Atari and other stuff. But for most of my ColecoVision, 80 plus ColecoVisions, they were boxed on shelves. And I thought, I sure could cram. Oh, it was 89 because I was buying Batman crap for the new movie. right. I could display some more Batman stuff up here on these shelves. And I was a man child. And if I got rid of all these boxes, so I threw away over 80 ColecoVision boxes in 89 and just kept the cartridges and manuals. I still have those cartridges and manuals, so that's cool. But man, I screwed myself out of thousands of dollars. Before I was gearing up for my Game & Watch debacle by throwing away a bunch of ColecoVision boxes. Just screwing myself out of a lot of money and cool gaming stuff.
And see, I never kept the boxes for anything I bought. Mm-hmm. Like, I would just, I don't even think I opened games carefully. I have a clear memory of, getting Mega Man 2 and just tearing the box open to get to the manual. Because, the fuck did I care? I was like, whatever. My mom, I wasn't allowed to keep the boxes. That was mm-hmm. the policy in my house. My mom was like, what the fuck are you keeping these boxes for? Right. They're just taking up room. And I was like, all right, whatever. The harpy. So fine, I'll throw them out. I never kept any of this stuff. And now... I look at my, I don't have a ton of stuff anymore. I did get rid of most of my stuff, but I have, the original NES Mega Man run. And I look at them and I go, just, man, I would love to just hang them on the wall in their boxes, because I'm never going to play the cards. I don't even have like my NES is in a box somewhere. You know, like if I want to play it, I'll emulate it because I own the game, so I'm allowed to. You know, but just to like have them up on the wall now, yeah, it's, I suppose it's a lesson, kids. Be hoarders.
Yeah.
Because you never know when your bullshit is going to be worth money.
Right.
I kept all my boxes, but they eventually got thrown away because I would, this is the kind of nerd that I was, and I always knew I was destined for retail, is I would like, I would play with the boxes and like set them up in super fancy ways and like stack them and line them up. And then being a small child, I would like accidentally step on them all the time because I'd be lining them up on the floor. And eventually, like, I think my parents just threw out the ones that were all crushed and whatnot, because I know I don't still have most of those boxes, but I also know that they were all precious to me at one point, so I know I didn't throw them away.
Your parents came in and gained them over the years. Playing with your toys, you know?
I mean, that's
what kids did.
Your parents came in and they were like, oh, shit, the kid's playing with boxes. What are we doing? Where did we go wrong? I know what Santa Claus is bringing him this year. Bunch of cardboard. Why do we waste money on this?
Just your mom brings home some boxes from work or something and just throw them under the tree. They're all empty, Mom.
My mom worked at Wawa, and like I'd go there in the summer and she'd let me fill the sodas in the walk-in. And like I'd go in there and do her job, and I thought it was the funnest thing in the world.
You know, what is this Wawa? I see Leonard Herman, I know, lives up in New York or whatever. What is we don't have Wawa down here in Texas.
Oh, you're in Texas. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So Wawa is like a convenience store. They also have gas station ones. They make really tasty sandwiches. They used to make way tastier sandwiches, but now they're just pretty tasty sandwiches.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember, cause I lived in Texas for 2 years, and, one of the gas stations in Texas has like a pretty decent convenience store attached to it. It's not Valero's. They do
Quick Trip.
No, it's not the Quick Trip. God damn it! This is gonna bother me now. Where are you in Texas? I don't know.
Fort Worth.
Okay, yeah, they would definitely be Fort Worth, because I lived in Midland and Corpus Christi, and they had them in both of those places. So I'm sure it's, but it's a similar thing, but way better. Like
Leonard Herman's always talking. He'll post something on Facebook about how the greatness of Wawa. Okay.
It really is, honestly. One of my wife's friends from California was just out here in November, and she obviously had never been to a Wawa, so we took Jen to Wawa. She was here for 2 days. We went to Wawa 7 times. She was like, "No, we have to go back. There's more stuff to try. I don't think you understand. I'm not going to be able to get it all in this trip." It is a life changing convenience store.
The one down here is called Bucky's. That's the one that our buddy loves down here. Mm-hmm. It's as big as a Sam's Warehouse, but it's a gas station. And it's
better than Bucky's.
Okay.
I promise. I've been to a Bucky's.
Okay.
I've been to a Bucky's.
We have better barbecue.
You're not wrong. Not even a little bit are you wrong. Stripes. There we go. It's Stripes in Texas.
Not familiar with that.
No? Okay. Maybe they're not in Fort Worth, but Stripes are kind of the same, like a Bucky's, like, you know.
Oh, you know what? I saw some in Lubbock. We were in Lubbock over the weekend
with
my daughter, and I saw some in Lubbock, but we didn't go in.
Yeah, Lubbock was, for Texas, it's close to Midland. It's 2.5 hours away, but that's pretty close in Texas.
Yeah, that's just a, you know, walking distance.
See, Chris doesn't understand this. You'll understand this, Brett. Like, when I lived in Corpus, we would drive the kids, like, on a Saturday morning, we would wake up and say, what do you want to do? And go, well, fucking nothing, because we live in Corpus, so we can go to the aquarium again. Or we could go to the zoo. And the closest zoo to Corpus is San Antonio. So 3.5 hours later, we're in San Antonio. But we didn't even think anything of it. It was like, well, that's just where we have to go. Like, people...
Right.
I think everybody should live in Texas for like a month just to get that experience of like nothing is anywhere near you.
Dallas-Fort Worth place. The Dallas-Fort Worth area pretty much has everything but beaches and mountains. And so if there's anything at all you want to do, it's in Dallas-Fort Worth. But, you know, we do like to go to the beach, you know, so I can drive 5 hours to Galveston.
Yeah.
You know, and if I want to go to – love to go to Austin and do the big, you know, 6th Street or the Capitol or other stuff, UT games. My wife graduated at UT Austin, you know, 3 hours. So basically, yeah. It's not like the Northeast where, you know, you can drive to, you know, 7 major metropolitan cities in, you know, about 30 minutes.
Yeah, no, Chris is one of my very best friends in the world, and I haven't seen him in person in almost a year, and he lives 35 minutes away from me. That in the Northeast is like, oh, God, do I really? It's not worth it. I don't like him that much. We're not married.
We talk. It's good enough. We talk. I need to see you.
Yeah.
I've been to Texas exactly 2 times. I was there once in a layover with a friend of mine. We were flying somewhere. I don't even remember, but that was that was just so we saw the inside of the airport and was like, well, that was neat. And then I was in a band and we did South by Southwest once, and that was awesome.
Cool. Yeah, Austin's the music capital. What do they call it? The live music capital of the world or something like that.
Yeah, it was. That was a cool place. I loved being there, and we ate at this just ridiculously good Mexican food place.
Oh, yeah.
Blew my mind. I wish I could remember the name of it, but it was like, oh, we went back there like 4 times. And yeah, we got some barbecue too, because barbecue in Texas is.
Yeah, the Tex-Mex and barbecue here is ridiculous. And we have the, outside of Dallas, we now have the National Video Game Museum. I guess you probably are aware.
I do. I'm because I'm from this side of the world, and I know Joe Santulli. And,
yeah.
I met him long, long ago. It's not like we're like close buddies or anything, but we know each other enough to talk when we see each other. And man, he had been talking about that for years, wanting to do that. And I was super stoked when he did it. I'd love to go out there and visit it. But
you know, it's really cool. It's 45 minutes from where I live. And I just went for my 10th time the other day. Wow. And I went to the grand opening. Before that, I went to the media event, since I write for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. So I cover the museum for, you know, with different events going on, beginning with the grand opening they did. And there was a VIP party or something that Leonard Herman invited me to and stuff, since he knew I lived down here and whatnot. So yeah, I'm always just looking for, now they have Dallas Retro Gamer meetups there about, you know, they've already done a couple there. So I'm always looking for an excuse to go to the video game museum. Right now, currently it's 10,000 square foot, and their ultimate goal is to have it to be 50,000 square foot. And it's already very impressive. Just, you know, they got classic arcade. They've got the museum laid out like levels of a video game. They've got a historical timeline laid out, and they've got like a mock-up of an old video game store during the 1983 video game crash, you know, just stuff like that. It's really, really cool.
Yeah, I think Ryan, our sponsor from the Stone Age Gamer, was talking about buying tickets for me and Chris to fly out to the, right? That was a thing? I hope so. When he listens to this show, we'll plant the seed, Chris.
If you ever do make it to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, let me know, and I'll tell you all the cool spots to go to around here.
Absolutely.
You know, there's you know, whether it's movie locations or just some cool things to do in Fort Worth, the Stockyards, you know, the Old West, the, you know, whatever. Lots of cool
things. Are any good arcades out by you?
There actually are. There's a Free Play Arcade in Richardson, which is north of Dallas, and there's another Free Play in Arlington. Each one of them has over 100 games set on Free Play, obviously by the name. But what's cool about it, it's only $10 to get in.
Nice.
And if you get there between, like, I can't remember if it's 2 or 3 and 3 and 4 when they open, the first hour you only pay $5. And you can come as long as you want. You can be there 10 hours and pay $10. You know, it's amazing.
Nice. Right, There's a place out here, Chris. Yeah.
When we go out, we're going to go to the Deep Ellen Brewery first.
There you go.
Deep Ellen makes incredible beers.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll go head out there.
That sounds like a plan.
All right.
We have a pay by the hour arcade in Red Bank, New Jersey, called Yestercades, which is where I've had my birthday for the last like 4 years, because it's like the happiest place on earth. And they do like an all day pass for like $25. You have unlimited access for all day, or you can do a pay by the hour. I don't even know how much the pay by the hour is, because I never don't do the day pass.
Right.
Because it doesn't matter how much it is. Like, if I'm going to Red Bank, which is like, you know, an hour and a half drive, like, I'm staying there all day. I will get up first thing in the morning, go out there and just park myself all day long and just play games.
Milk it for all it's worth.
Yeah.
Last year when I turned 50, I had my birthday at the Free Play Arcade in Arlington, which is about 25 minutes from Fort Worth. And I invited a lot of friends that were really kind of non-gamers and, you know, my gamer friends and non-gamer friends and whatnot. But, you know, the people that, even the non-gamers were like, wow, you know, they were just blown away and they had a blast just, you know, playing games that they remember from their childhood or from when they were teenagers or whatever, and just absolutely loved it.
They have console games there too, or just arcades?
It's all arcades, and some, maybe each one has maybe 10 or 12 pinballs and the rest are coin-op video games.
Nice. Yeah, yes, arcades has... One, oh, go ahead.
We do have one arcade that's even closer to my house that it's called Quarter Lounge, and they have an interesting system where you pay like $3.50 to get in, and then you pay a quarter for games. But then if you pay $5.50, you also have access to the consoles, and then they've got a library of games behind the counter that you can just borrow. So you can pay $5.50 and then play free console games or quarter arcade games. It's really cool.
Yeah, Yestercades has, they probably have, I don't know, I think maybe 15 pinball games lined up. Mm-hmm. The one in Red Bank that I go to usually has Twilight Zone, which is my favorite pinball game, which makes me super happy. And then they usually have a bunch of them, and they rotate them because they have like a big basement underneath and they rotate their games all the time. And they got a ton of arcade cabinets. I couldn't even estimate how many they have on the floor, but they also have these two, technically three setups. They have one old, like old tube TV, like the ones that are in the wood framed, look like old furniture from the 70s. Yeah. They have one of those and a beanbag chair. Yeah, I had one of those too. They have one of those on the floor with a beanbag chair, and that's what they have the Atari hooked up to. They got an Atari 2600, and I think the option for Intellivision, ColecoVision cooked up to that. But then they have two TVs on either side, big flat screens, and they've got the modern stuff like your Wii U, super modern, but like PS4, Xbox One, all the way back to NES, Super NES. They got Atari Jaguar. They got there's 3DOs there, one or two of them, and they're just set up. And you ask for the games behind the counter. Someone will come out, put the game in, and you just sit on these couches and play these games for however long you want, unless there's like a birthday party scheduled or something. I love that place. Like, even though I have a lot of the games at home, like even the, you know, emulated on my Raspberry Pi, the arcade games, and I have the console games, probably all of them myself anyway, there's just something about sitting on a couch and playing those games in an arcade environment. That's just so wonderful.
Absolutely. Yes, it's funny you mentioned the beanbag and the TV like that. I mean, in our living room, we had one of the bigger TVs in the neighborhood. It was like a 25 or 27 inch TV on the floor, you know, the big furniture style TV. And I remember we had one of like the first remote control for your TV, and then, or one of the first in the neighborhood. It had two buttons on it, an on and off and a channel switcher. And you'd push the channel switcher and it'd go, and then the channels would just rotate through all like seven channels or whatever there were. And I had my blue beanbag propped in front of my TV with the ColecoVision hooked up to it.
And the TV weighed 7,000 pounds.
Yeah, no doubt. But around that time, we actually got cable TV. And my dad, you know, they were pretty frugal, but he was a big fan of, you know, sitting in the stereotypical, you know, working all day and then coming home, sitting in the recliner. And so he did spring for cable. And some friends of mine at school had told me how you could take apart the cable box and rig it where you would get all the channels. And so, you know, just being a 15, 16, whatever I was when we got cable, 14, whatever it was, kid, I was, you know, had no compunctions about doing that. That sounded amazing. And so, you know, we got Showtime and HBO and Skinamax and all this stuff. You know, it's that kind of eye-opening. But yeah, back then, they later made the cable boxes where they were harder to open, and it was very esoteric how you would, you know, you had to actually know what you were doing. But those first cable boxes, all you had to do was, you know, you needed a Phillips head, I think, and you just had to bend this piece of metal away from the little tuner inside to keep it from touching it. And then somehow you would get all the channels. And so we had full-blown cable.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. It worked out for us. My brother and I would stay up late, you know, watching all these R-rated movies and stuff. So good times.
Now, when I was a kid, it was all just, you know, going to the scrambled channels and trying to figure out what I was looking at.
I did that too before I figured out how to rig it. I watched this black and white scramble. I think it was black and white just because it was turned that way for the, you know, because it was the same way they scrambled it, you know, just.
Yeah.
Just a scrambled, horrible, I'm sure, movie just because I could get a glimpse of a boob and a butt cheek every once in a while.
That's right.
Yeah, that's how we did it back then.
Kids these days, their cell phones and their internet, they don't know how good they have it.
They right. really don't. It was a treat to watch a scramble. There's a boob up there and there's a boob down there at the bottom. They're really split far apart, but it's two boobs. It's definitely a woman. I'm excited.
I just saw three boobs.
Three boobs, fantastic. This is the best movie ever.
Yeah, I mean, when we were kids and we were riding our bikes all over the place, we had one of our friends had found some magazine, I don't know what, Penthouse or something, and, you know, it just stayed under this tree near this dried out pond where we'd ride our bikes and, you know, every day or two, ride over there and look at the magazine and then, you know, keep riding.
The magazine that our friends and I found went under my friend James. We went to his house and he was able to pull up the air conditioning vent and he hid it between the carpet and the floorboards.
Oh, nice.
And so I would, like, you know, go over there and borrow it, and that's where the magazine stayed, in the carpet beneath the
hiding stuff in air conditioner vents long before Dexter.
Long right? before
like, kept the TV show, down. You know, that's where he hid all his like killing implements and things. Or no, his blood samples. He kept them behind the air conditioning. Yeah, that's what it was.
Dan knows Dexter. I've never seen it.
Oh, okay. The first couple of seasons are
Chris
great.
Is a heathen.
Yeah. I recommend the first two seasons for sure.
Yeah, that's one of those shows that, like, I've been told to watch a billion times. Like, all right, well, I'm watching something else first. You know, only so many hours in the day, but
right.
I'll get Dexter eventually. We still need to finish Breaking Bad. We're on, like, season two, and we started it, like, 2 years ago. So
that's really sad.
Yeah.
I have seen exactly 3 seconds of that show. Like, I wouldn't even recognize it if it was on. Be like, is that the guy? I don't know. Whatever. Click. It's too much. I'm sure.
Well, the first episode turns a lot of people off. You got Walter White, just this old man and his tidy whities, and you know, you're just like, okay, this is kind of weird and gross, but hang into it for 3 or 4 episodes and it's like crack.
Yeah, no, I was more meth. Huh.
Yeah, or meth.
See what you did there.
I was in. It wasn't like we stopped watching it because we didn't like it. It was just like other things kept happening and
right. Sure.
Anyway, all right. Well, we should take ourselves a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more to Brett about the books that he's got and all the things that are going on in his fantastic professional existence. So you're listening to the Stone Age Gamer podcast from Geekade.com. Stick around.
Now here's a look at some of the other original content available right now at Geekade.com.
First up, it's a brand new year, so maybe you're looking for a brand new way to get organized. Bullet journaling is all the rage these days, and Karen is a sucker for any excuse to buy new stationery. Learn the ins and outs of this new hobby and find out whether it might just be the thing to keep you on track in A Geek's Guide to Bullet Journaling, located in the Think Tank. Then, in 2018, Dan has decided to jump on the indie train and find the focus of each month's Bits and Brews pairing by pairing an indie New Jersey brewery selection with suitable indie games. First up, from Carton Brewing in Atlantic Highlands, New Jersey, comes Regular Coffee Imperial Cream Ale. And from Thunder Lotus Games comes Jotun, or I forget how Dan pronounces it. He's not here, because I'm doing these commercials alone. An action-adventure game that weaves in elements of Norse mythology. Find out what makes these two work so well together in Bits and Brews 28, Regular Coffee and Jotun. I'm going with Jotun. Finally, do you like Power Bricks? Who doesn't like Power Bricks? Oh wait, nobody likes Power Bricks because Power Bricks are awful. Power bricks are humongous, and they take up lots of space, and they make lots of heat. And you know who really hates power bricks? Matt Much. Well, he wrote an entire article about how much he hates power bricks, and I think you should go read it. So go over to the think tank and check out Incredible Feats of Engineering, except by Matt Much. You can catch all this great stuff, plus tons of other articles, videos, podcasts, and more right now at Geekade.com.
We are back, still talking wonderful video games with Mr. Brett Weiss here. And so, Brett, let's talk about your books and whatnot. Let's talk about the actual things that you do, the creating that you create. So,
right.
I have the best words.
That's so good.
The creating you create.
Awesome. That's
talk
good.
Words that... to us, Brett.
All right. Well,
talk words at us.
Hi, I'm a professional editor.
Well, my full-time job is writing. I write for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, which is a major metropolitan newspaper, and I write for a weekly newspaper called Antique Week, which does collectibles. I've got a national column in there called the Pop Culture Collective, where I talk about movies, books, video games, records, music, et cetera, et cetera. And I've written for Film Facts, Fangoria, Game Informer, on and on and on. Lots of different magazines, newspapers, etc. I've actually had more than 1,500 articles published in print and online, etc., etc. And I've always been a reader, and I've always been interested in books and things like that, comics, science fiction, horror, the Guinness Book of World Records. I grew up just obsessing over all that good stuff. But I never really took school or writing all that seriously. I sort of goofed off and was into, you know, ColecoVision and girls and all that kind of stuff in school, you know, Atari and whatnot, and just the social scene of it. And I worked full time in high school like an idiot, you know. So I never really took the academic stuff seriously until I was a couple years out of school and went back to college. And then I got married and settled down and all that good stuff. And I started doing something in the early to mid 90s that I've always wanted to do, sit down and actually start writing. So I started working on a Sega Genesis and Super Nintendo book, and it was going to be called Captain Cartridge Rates the Games. I had a little mascot for it and everything, and I was cataloging all these Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis games. It was going to be kind of like, it was just basically sort of an encyclopedia or just a Leonard Maltin's book of games, but for what was current at the time, you know, early 90s, Sega Genesis, Super Nintendo, mid-90s, whatnot. And I could not find a publisher, because in the 90s, that was a hard thing to do. Like, Leonard Herman had a hard time finding a home for Phoenix for a good while. And
he self-published that, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He ended up self-publishing it, and his Rolenta Press, and I should have done that with this Super Nintendo Sega Genesis book I was working on, but I was turned down by several publishers. And anyway, I was also writing fiction at the time, so that book just kind of went away. I didn't finish that, but I was writing fiction at the time too. And I was getting published in some small press magazines, and with the advent, with the internet getting ubiquitous, I started writing for some online magazines too. That was supposed to be the next big wave of science fiction horror. Before ebooks, there was webzines, and there were webzines, and that was going to be the next big wave of science fiction short stories, like you had in the 30s, 40s, and 50s with the old, you know, Weird Tales and all that. And that never quite panned out, but anyway, neither did my fiction writing. And so, but in 1997, my brother-in-law sent me a classified ad for something called the All Game Guide. And It was an online database that's mission was to catalog, describe, and review every single game that had ever come out in the history of creation for every console, every handheld, every computer. And you could do as much as you wanted, you know, as long as, you know, you just put in reserved what games you wanted, and you could, you know, I had a massive collection of, you know, and all these resources. So I was cranking out descriptions right and left. And when I had a chance to play the games, I'd do reviews. And so I was working at Walden Books at the time. I'd actually got so much work with the All Game Guide, and they made me an editor for several of the consoles, that I actually quit my job at Walden Books and was writing full time. I started writing for the All Game Guide and the Comics Buyer's Guide, which was a long running. Yeah, I was doing that. I was on the review crew for that. That had started, you know, decades ago. That was, you know, one of the big major comic book publications. So at that point, I was writing for the All Game Guide and Comics Buyer's Guide, and I started publishing in different magazines, toy model, toy car and model, and toy collector, just all these different magazines at the time. And after 9/11, the All Game Guide, they really, you know, there was a big downturn in just about every aspect of economic, you know, there's a big economic downturn, you know, in business. 9/11 hurt businesses overall because it just sort of depressed everyone. It depressed the economy as well. And after 9/11, the All Game Guide let go all of their offsite writers. It was based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And they let go all their offsite writers and editors and everybody. And I was just absolutely devastated because I'd been doing that. And just, you know, it was my dream job, working at home, and I had little kids. And so I could work during their naps or late at night. And it was something fun I could do. And so I was super bummed out about that. And so I told my friend about this, just, you know, one of my best friends, you know, I was just telling him, man, I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, I got these little kids at home. I had this great job I loved. It's gone. Well, at the time, it just so happened he was he worked for a garage door company, and he was trying to start his own company. And he said, man, I'll pay you to just kind of help me with this to, you know, get it off the ground and get the word out and stuff. So I started a couple of days a week just putting out flyers and business cards and whatnot and just helping him. And he started paying me commission for jobs I was getting. So it was doing really well. And then I started dispatching and answering the phone all that. And so while I was dispatching, you know, it's not like a pizza place where you're getting, you know, 50, 60 calls. You know, it's a garage door company. So I'd get a handful of calls a day, you know, just for big jobs. And so all those hours in between left me time to write. And so when I was through moping about the All Game Guide, and I thought, well, see, one other bummer about the All Game Guide, they were just on the verge of publishing a series of books, and they were going to have me working on these books too, in addition to the database. And I was like, wow, this is awesome. Well, they canceled the book series. And so I got to thinking, you know, I'm just going to do these books myself. And so like a crazed OCD maniac, I started with 1972, the Magnavox Odyssey, and worked my way up through the Atari 2600, 5200 ColecoVision and all that, and wrote a description, a write-up with critical comment for a lot of the games, for every single game, every U.S. release, for the Odyssey, Magnavox Odyssey, all the way up to the ColecoVision and Atari 5200, the Vectrex, and all the classic systems pre-NES. And I shopped around. I had gone to the San Diego Comic-Con and met a publisher there called McFarlane. And I had read, you know, a lot of their movie books and esoteric reference guides and stuff. So I pitched this classic home video games book to them, and they loved the idea because at that point they had not published any. It's a publisher that's been around at least since the 80s, probably the 70s. But they had never published a single book on video games, even though they published film and sports and, you know, all these reference books and different things and entertainment. They had never touched a video game book, and they loved this idea. And so then that led to volume 2 and volume 3 over the, and just last year, my first classic home video games book was published in 2007. So last year was the 10th anniversary of that. And last year was also the 20th anniversary of the first time I had a short story published. And so today, McFarlane Publishers, which does the classic home video game series, they have a whole line of video game books published by, you know, a variety of authors. So it's kind of cool that the classic home video games book was the first of all that. So that 2007, you know, the first classic home video games book a decade ago, that was right around the time that retro gaming started its big mainstream push with, you know, like we mentioned earlier, the YouTubers and the Wii Shop channel and a variety of other things. So I sort of rode that crest of, I mean, you could say I maybe was a tiny part of it, or that I just sort of rode the wave of retro gaming getting, you know, mainstream and all that. Anyway, so I've been working on the classic home. I mean, I've got the three classic home video game books that go up through the Sega Genesis. Well, what happened, it was time to start to do the fourth and final volume, because that was going to be the Super Nintendo, Atari Jaguar, the 3DO and CDI. And I was like, okay, this is going to be, this is, you know, it's just, these books are taking a long time, and the video game book publishing industry has changed a lot. There's now these big full color coffee table books. You know, when I published the first classic home video game books, most video game books were black and white, or they had, you know, just a few photos, and production values were fairly low on a lot of them. Well, things had changed over 10 years, and I thought, you know, I'm gonna see if I can do a full color hardcover coffee table book covering just the Super Nintendo, because that's such a popular system and everything. And instead of just having descriptions and whatnot, I was going to get reach out to a lot of people in the industry and get them to contribute stories, you know, get some personality and color to the book with people writing stories of growing up playing the games and things. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've been working on, is the SNES Omnibus. Volume 1 will be out in the spring or summer. I'm keeping my fingers crossed for the spring. And then Volume 2 will follow probably about a year later. I'm working on Volume 2 now. Volume 1 is pretty much done. I'm just waiting for them to send me back the final pages to proof.
And you're split those up alphabetically, right?
Yeah, SNES Omnibus Volume 1 covers A through M. And then obviously Volume 2 will cover N through Z. And it's comprehensive with U.S. releases. So there's more than 350 games in Volume 1.
Wow. And I was going to say there's... So. The split works like that? Because I imagine the at least looking at my collection, the majority of Super Nintendo games start with the letter S. But
yeah, it actually divides up pretty well. There's so many games called Super, but then if you look at, you know, there's a ton of M games, so it works out pretty well.
Oh, okay,
it's a good even split. Yeah,
but that's good. I heard it was splitting up. I figured, all right, the first volume is going to be like A through R, and then volume two is just S to the end of the right. alphabet with all the super games. But no, I guess I'm glad that works out.
But this I have such a fun project. Oh, go ahead.
I have almost bought the classic home video games books a ton of time. I know that's not the most fun thing to hear from somebody, but I have looked at them on Amazon.
I have almost given you money a bunch of times.
Because they've been on my Amazon Christmas wish list for years, and nobody's bought them for me. And
I
it was
tell you, I've had very few. They've reviewed really well, and I've had few to no, very little buyer's remorse. People are really happy with them.
Well, I mean, it goes to kind of what you were saying is how much this stuff has changed over the years. Like, if I had discovered these earlier, I probably would have bought them, no question. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's looking at the previews and seeing there's no pictures and anything like that, and then it's just all you know.
Well, there
no,
are
not. There's the no pictures. Of, there's some.
There are
pictures.
Photos, but yeah, they're black and white, and they're the consoles and the boxes and things. And
yeah,
with the SNES Omnibus, there's going to be over 2,000 full color photos with screenshots and old magazine ads and boxes and cartridges and, you know, you name it. It's gonna be full.
That's
fully
awesome.
Loaded. Well, with the classic home video game series, I mean. What inspired me to do those in part were, you know, Leonard Maltin's old movie reference books.
Yeah.
And those were just, you know, a paragraph or two about each movie. And I thought, you know, there had never been anything like this done for video games. I mean, you had the digital press books and those are great, but a lot of those are just the title, the year, and a checkbox.
And exactly. Some rarity levels,
rarity
maybe a sentence or two about them.
Yeah,
I also have to say, like, and the thing that drew me to them in the first place is the covers. The covers on these books are just fantastic.
Oh, and the classic home video games books?
The classic home video games books. I love all three of them. Who did you do those? Did you have somebody do
those
for you?
Those were actually designed by the publisher. I had a little input. You know, they would run them by me to see what I thought. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was real the publisher design. That's one good thing about having an actual publisher instead of self-publishing. They handle all the design work with the text, with the cover, with the formatting and all that stuff. So
I remember that was something Leonard had problems with, was his covers. He's very self-deprecating about his original Phoenix.
Yeah, just the title. Well, again, you know, those were early. You know, there just weren't many video game books at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember going to, after the first classic home video games book was published, let's see, I was at the 2007 or 8 Classic Gaming Expo in Vegas. And I didn't have a booth and I wasn't a guest or anything because I was, you know, my book had just come out. Nobody knew who I was at the time. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to take a bunch of books with me and see what happens. Well, there's the Saturday morning of the show, of the first day of the show, I have 20 books with me, and I just go through the line, and I'm showing everybody the book. I sold 17 $50 hardcover black and white books. I sold 17 in line just talking to people. Actually, there were 50. The suggested retail, they were actually $55. Because McFarland, I mean, they're a specialty publishing house, so their cover prices are a little steep for, you know, the hardcovers. Mm-hmm. The soft cover books are now $25, which is pretty good and which is pretty standard, you know, for an oversized soft cover book. But the hardcovers at the time were, you know, $55 per book, and it was people. I sold, as a matter of fact, Nolan Bushnell was at that show. And I showed him the book, you know, the 1972 through 1984 classic comedy games that had just come out and everything. And he was like, wow. He was amazed about the production values of it. You know, the textbook binding, the really heavy paper stock, they're black and white, but they basically look like a textbook you would have in college. And he was just floored that. He goes, I can't believe, you know, think about this. This was 10 years ago before this retro gaming book craze that seems to be going on. Mm-hmm. And he was just like, wow, it's so cool to see Atari covered this way, you know, with such durable binding and taken seriously and, you know, published by a professional publisher and all that good stuff. So, yeah, the market has changed tremendously in the last 10 years with the books, you know, and the production values, you know, I just thought, you know, I switched publishers from McFarland to Schiffer. Schiffer, the Hundred's Greatest Console Video Games, 1977 through 1987, which came out a couple of years ago, that book was my first to actually appear in Barnes & Noble. And I remember my publisher emailing me and saying, hey, I got good news. All 600 and something Barnes and Nobles in the United States have each ordered, you know, X number of books of your 100 greatest book. And I was like, okay, this is cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So my wife and I, he told me when it was going to happen and all that. And so my wife and I, it was a few, I don't know, a month later or whatever, we go up to Barnes and Noble and there's my books there on the end cap with, I think I don't remember which, some other gaming books that were fairly well known at the time that were, I was like, okay, this is great. You know, had my picture made by it and all that stuff. Now, that was really an exciting moment.
That's very
so, yeah,
cool.
But the change to Schiffer was really, McFarlane is, you know, it's a good publishing company too, you know, for what they do, but just with the production. And I do a lot of shows, you know, retro gaming shows and, mm-hmm. You know, to have a nice full color book with screenshots and all that tend to sell better at shows, you know, just something people want autographed and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what you're saying is that you're a legitimate version of us. You're an us that gets paid to do it. Compared to
well,
this nonsense is that we're doing.
It's well, you know, the books are nice and everything, and they're great to take to shows, and they're a good. It's cool, you know, setting up and doing the autographings, and it looks good on my resume. But most, you know, 90% of my income I get from articles for newspapers and magazines and stuff, just because it's a day in, day out thing. And the books,
yeah, you know, see, nobody will even pay us to do that.
Right. Yeah.
I'll tell you. It's a racket.
I recently started writing.
I get paid a little bit to write for Stone Age Gamer. And
well, I don't, Chris.
I did actually get paid to write in a Nintendo Force once or twice. So.
Oh, cool. That's cool. You're a professional author.
I am a professional author, dadgummit.
Or at least a published one.
I've never submitted anything, but I don't know that, you know.
Yeah, everything we do here on Geekade is 100% free. We don't pay anybody for anything, and we don't charge anyone for it.
Well, it's called the labor of love, and that's cool.
That's right.
That is very true. It is a labor of love, and
it's a great
especially
hobby.
The labor part.
But, right.
talking to this guy every week is tough enough.
Oh, yeah. I know.
I'm just kidding. Yeah. The 100 greatest console video games book, the only reason I didn't buy that was because it was on my Christmas list. And like, I'd look at it in stores and be like, no, don't buy yourself something in November, you jackass. And that I just haven't gotten around to buying it yet, but it's on my list of things to pick up. They have it at my local game store, actually, Level Up in the Hamilton Mall. At least they did have it. I don't know if they still do. They had a handful of copies of it, and I know that they were selling it. All the guys
there
were talking about it.
Diamond Comic Distributors. They picked it up, and so a lot of gaming stores order things, you know, certain things through Diamond. Like I know the Digital Press Store ordered a bunch of copies through Diamond because they get
book.
Gaming related comics and stuff. Oh, thank you.
You doing a second one of those?
I've been asked that a lot, and I hope to at some point. The SNES Volume 2, Omnibus Volume 2, is going to take up my time for the next probably 3 or 4 months. But at some point, I hope to start on a sequel because I've been asked a lot, and I think it would be cool to cover either the next decade or the next 2 decades. I'm going to have to sit down and look at, you know, I'll either do 88 to 98 or 88 to 2008.
Ooh.
But I think I might just do the next decade because I'd have to leave out a lot of games to cover 20 years.
Yeah,
I would leave out a lot of really cool games.
Yeah. There's so much good stuff between 88 and 98.
Like, oh, gosh, it's crazy. Yeah,
you could easily fill a book of 100 awesome console games from that.
Well, some people have asked me, why didn't you just do 100 greatest video games book of all time? You know, that would have sold better or whatever. And I was like, well, you know, I could do that, but I'm really passionate about the old, you know, the Atari and ColecoVision and all that, NES, you know, the early NES stuff, because, you know, I grew up with that, and that's my field of expertise, and a lot of those games get ignored, and if I did of all time, you know, there might be 10 of those old ones on there, 15 or 20 or whatever, as opposed to, you know, just a book full of them. I wanted to really spotlight a lot of the games that get lost to time or, you know, some of the
This is definitely the right call. I mean, the book's awesome, and with it, those limitations. Because, yeah, like you said, everyone, you think about games from 77 to 87, so you've got this crazy like run of like a chunk of NES games all compared against ColecoVision games and whatnot. And there's so many ubiquitous titles that are more popular now. Like I talked to other collectors. I just recently went going through a collecting phase where I wanted to get all the color box Atari published games. And that was one of the reasons, not only because I love those things from when I was a kid looking through the Atari catalog, but because collecting Atari games is reasonable still. Whereas anything with the Nintendo name on it has just skyrocketed with collectors. It's just insanity. And collecting has become so kind of difficult because of how popular that stuff is. But I feel like a lot of these really just genuinely fun games get so overlooked by younger gamers today because I don't know, I guess because they don't have the Nintendo branding on them or something, but there's genuinely like these games, and a lot of them haven't aged extraordinarily well, but a lot of them still play great. Like I was playing Frogger with my 4-year-old, like the Atari 2600 version of Frogger. He thought it was
still fun.
Hilarious. It's still fun. And
well, that was the main criteria for this book, The 100 Greatest. Each game had to still, at least in my opinion, still hold up today. I mean, I didn't put any titles in there strictly because they were historically important. I mean, I didn't put Utopia for the Intellivision or Superman for the 2600. Those are both very, those are two examples I use of games that were very ahead of their time. You know, Utopia, the strategy, and Superman, the story and the different scenarios and multiple screens and all that, you know, way ahead of its time. And they didn't make it because I just don't think they hold up that well. And so there's very few sports games in the book. I think PBA Bowling for the Intellivision made it. And, you know, there's a Video Olympics, which is basically Pong.
Yeah.
But Pong holds up, you know.
Pong does hold up.
Yeah,
I like
really
a lot
does.
Of old NES, like any sports games past NES, I don't really care for. I know everyone loves like NHL 94 and whatnot, but I love all like a handful, like Tecmo Baseball is. Everyone talks about Tecmo Bowl. I freaking love Tecmo Baseball. There's something about the brilliant simplicity of video game sports. You know how like you look at something like Video Pinball, and it's like you can do things that are just simulating pinball, like Pinball Arcade, but then you also have pinball video games that could never possibly exist in reality because they're doing video type stuff. I liked that kind of the gamey aspect of old sports games because they played like video games with sports rules. You know, they didn't really play
That's
like
true, right. They didn't try to, or they don't, whether they tried or not, they don't necessarily simulate the sport, but they're definitely video games. I know exactly what you mean.
They're very video gamey. And I love that kind of stuff. I love going back to, I mean, even as hideous as football for 2600 is, like, there's still some fun to be had in that weird game that just you can barely even tell it's football or Pele soccer even. That game I used to have a lot of fun with my sister. The weird
you're liking some games that I don't even like.
I'm not calling them all time classics, but they're just,
well, a lot of it has to do that, you know, some of those have to do, you know, if you grew up playing them, you got a ton of. I mean, I love Double Dribble and Blades of Steel.
Oh, Blades of Steel is
so
wonderful.
Great.
Wonderful.
Yeah,
game.
Absolutely.
Absolutely holds up to this day.
Yeah, no doubt.
There's in the latest version of the show, which is about as modern a sports game as you can possibly get, there is a retro mode. And it is just old school, hit X, and the pitcher throws the ball. And if you hold down, it's a fastball. And if you hold up, it's like a changeup. And, like, you can move the batter in the box left and right and – you know, you're not aiming the stick and guessing the pitch and trying to put spin on the ball and all this other shit. Like, it is just, it's like playing NES baseball. It's like playing, you know, bases loaded and whatever.
Nice.
It's awesome. You know, except it's got all the modern players. But if you hit a home run, like the old school, like 8-bit lettering comes across the screen. And there's like a chintzy voiceover. It's just, home run. Like, and that's it. It's fantastic.
So yeah, I really like, I mean, there's some complex games I really enjoy, but I'm a big fan of simplicity with when it comes to video games. Usually I just want something to pick up and play, you know.
So do you have modern consoles? What do you play these days?
I do. I was actually fortunate enough, Nintendo actually sent me a Switch and a couple of games, so that was really cool. Because I do, for the Fort Worth Star Telegram, I do quarterly video game guides, like spring, summer, fall, and holiday. Mm-hmm. And I do other gaming-related articles for them. So I'm in pretty good with Nintendo. They send me a lot of stuff. So I've got a 3DS XL. I've got a Switch. I've got a Wii U. I've got an Xbox 360. And I've got the game room upstairs at my house is pretty big, and it's pretty much devoted to gaming and movie watching and stuff. So I've got tables lining the walls with probably about 40, a little over 40 consoles set up ready to play on all the original hardware and cartridges and whatnot. So that's pretty cool. So I have around the walls, I have tables set up with CRT TVs and all the hookups and everything with the old systems. And then I've got a couch facing the opposite direction with a modern TV and the DVDs and the 360 and the Wii U and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I keep, been enjoying Mario Odyssey, and, I like, the Donkey Kong Country game on the Wii U a lot. That's really good.
Yeah, I finished that recently, actually.
Tropical Freeze, I think it is, right?
Yeah, Tropical Freeze. I just finished it. I'm going to buy it again when it comes out on Switch.
Oh, cool. Nice.
I really enjoyed it, and I'd like to be able to just kind of play it on the go, and hopefully the Switch version has shorter load times.
Right.
Okay, load times are brutal.
Yeah, but I follow modern game. Like, I don't have a PS4 or an Xbox One, but I follow.
Neither do I.
You know, since I do the game guides for the paper, you know, I follow what's going on, and I keep, and just I'm interested in it anyway. So I follow, but you know, as far as Overwatch and like Uncharted and all that stuff, I don't play any of that stuff. I mean, I just played a little. My son, when he had when he still lived at home and had his 360 and stuff, I'd play some of those, you know, some of that with him, Call of Duty and whatnot, Star Wars, Battlefront and what, you know, I do some of that, but a lot of the big, expansive modern games, the A-list titles, I just don't have time or don't have the system for it for a lot of that kind of stuff. But I have my foot in the waters of the new stuff, but I'm pretty retro most of the time.
So you sound very similar to my tastes. I tend to gravitate towards things with even modern games with retro sensibilities. I do make some exceptions. I really loved the first two Uncharted games. I never did any of them past that.
I heard 4 was just incredible. Some people called 4 like the greatest video game of all time and stuff.
It's up there. It's really, mm-hmm. really, really good.
Cool. There are just some modern games that just transcend that. They reached out to me and say, all right, you need to play this. I know it's not that 2D side scroller. Like, you know, I'm looking at the games coming out soon that I'm excited about. And the indie game Celeste is really speaking to me. Like, I can't wait to play that. And I tend to gravitate a lot towards those kinds of games. Like, I play a lot of the new Spelunker that's on the Switch because I loved the original Spelunker, and this new one is great.
Cool. And
pricey, but it's still, you know, it's still Spelunker to the nth degree. But, you know,
well, I blew through Shovel Knight when it came out.
Shovel Knight's great.
Yeah, my son downloaded it to my, what system? I think it was the Wii U. Yeah, he downloaded that for like my birthday or something. And I was just, wow, this is amazing. So, yeah, I like the modern stuff that has a retro feel to it. And I mean, I'd love to have time to put 100 hours into the new Zelda for the Switch or something. I just don't seem to have the time. You know, I have a lot of other interests too. I do a lot of bicycling, and I ride a lot, obviously. But you know, just I have a variety of things I do, and a lot of times it just seems easier to sit down and play a game for an hour or two than, you know, invest into these really heavy story-driven, complex games. You know, it's just easier for me to throw on. Like the other day, I was playing, what was it for the? Anyway, this, for the Genesis, I love the side scrollers like Gary's and. Thunder Force and all that kind of stuff. Big fan of the arcade conversions to the NES, like Popeye and Joust and Donkey Kong 3, that kind of stuff. So I still play that kind of stuff quite a bit.
I forget that you just reminded me. I saw Donkey Kong 3 on the greatest list, and I was like, wow, I don't feel like there's a lot of folks out there who have lots of love for Stan and the Bugman.
So, yeah, that one, Donkey Kong 3 is such a strange, people just can't seem to get over the fact that it's a Donkey Kong game. I think if you just forget about what the characters, you know, just play it as a shooter, it's a really cool, really fun game.
I love that game.
Yeah, absolutely. It's challenging. It's different with the platforms and the shooting element.
It's hard,
Yeah, it gets really challenging after a few screens. It's a ton of fun. It's a great port.
I kind of using what you were just saying before about shoot 'em ups and kind of segue back to your Super NES Omnibus. I forget, did I get to write about UN Squadron? I know that was one of the ones I had mentioned I could write about.
That is entirely possible. I don't recall off the top of my head.
I don't either. I know I did a bunch of them, but UN Squadron is like my favorite scrolling shooter ever. I adore that game. And it'll never get ported to anything ever because of the licensing issues. But
there's so many of those games that are just lost to time. But there's so many. I mean, in some ways, the contributor list for the SNES Omnibus, looking at Volume 1 here, it's like a who's who. I mean, you got Blake Harris, contributed stories, author of Console Wars, Kurt Collada of Hardcore Gaming 101, Tim Lepetino, Art of Atari, Sean Long, RGT85 on YouTube. His channel has just really blown up lately. Rob McCallum, the filmmaker, 8-Bit Eric, I mean, Benjamin Reeves, senior editor for Game Informer, John Riggs, some guys that used to write for the old magazines like Greg Stewart, former previews and reviews editor for Electronic Gaming Monthly.
Oh, Steve, Greg Stewart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Steve Wojta, I don't know if he's Wojta or Wojta, he used to program games for the Genesis, and he's been programming, still programs for a lot of systems. But yeah, I've got YouTubers like Brittany Brombacker of BlondNerd.com, you know, Blonde Nerd Comedy or BlondNerd.com. Got all kinds of, for the next volume, Kelsey Lewin, the YouTuber, is doing a story. And yeah, some people I reached out to said they were interested, but then I never heard back, you know, when I sent them all the, maybe all the parameters were just, you know, I sent all these, I don't know, writing, you know, it is work, you know, and it was pretty much volunteer driven as far as the contributions. People were either passionate about contributing their stories or they weren't. And the ones that didn't just, and that's fine. I mean, there's no, you know, obligation by anybody that said they would contribute and then they didn't. That's fine. You know, it's, you know, asking a lot of people to, you know, just contribute stories. It takes time and it's hard work and stuff. But boy, I got some really, really good stories. And what's cool about them, the phrase I heard the most of, or when I was going through editing the stories that people wrote, people talking about how these games are, you know, have a special place in their heart. Sometimes I had to edit that out even because it started becoming monotonous because just that particular phrasing. I mean, I kept the spirit of what they would say, but I couldn't just have story after story say that. I had, you know, being an editor and writer and all that, you have to make it where you're not redundant. But the sentiment I would leave in, because these games are important to so many people and certain titles that people grew up playing. I mean, I've got stories of people bonding with their grandmother over a game, with their dad that didn't talk much, but maybe he was real animated playing a game. Special trips to Toys R Us, you know, those magical, when you get those little sheets off the racks and take them up to that magical building or little magical room at the front of the store, and where you could see all those games when you got a glimpse when they would open the door.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really transports you back to the 90s when you would rent games from Blockbuster, all kinds of stories like that. The stories people contributed were mostly from a personal slant, you know, because I wrote a description of each game along with, you know, a lot of critiques and whatnot. And then I also included, you know, quotes from other sources like vintage magazines, from websites and whatnot, just to give you a good, well-rounded look at each game. But the stories, there were 79 different contributors to Volume 1, and most of the stories are very personal in nature as far as how particular games affected them growing up, or programmer stories, things like that. So, yeah, you got a good variety of writers and stories in the book. So I think the best part of this book is not going to be what I wrote, because, you know, I wrote a good lengthy write-up for each game, you know, 150 to 400 words or so on each game, you know, enough to where you're not going on and on, but you get a good look at the game, you know, especially with the screenshots and everything. But then a lot of the games are supplemented with these personal stories that really, I think, are going to be the heart of the book.
So we're running kind of long here. I guess we should probably start wrapping this up. We do have a question that we ask every guest we ever have on the show. So the question is, what bread is the best bread?
What bread is the best bread? I'm glad you asked me that.
Are you, though? Are you really?
I'm neutral. No, I'm kidding. No, I actually like a really, like, a bread with seeds and grain and whole grain and brown wheat, you know, a really good pithy bread, I should say, you know, like a healthy bread that's got a lot of substance to it.
I don't think we've ever had that as an answer.
I don't think we have either. Yeah. The word pithy, that might be the first time the word pithy has been used on our show.
Yeah. So I like a bread with substance, you know, some weight to it, and, you know, that's good for you.
Good answer.
This is what we get for talking to East Coast guys most of the time. We're like, bad Jewish rye bread. That's what we like.
Right.
Give me something that's horrible for you.
Yeah. I like a good multigrain bread.
There you go.
That's a damn fine answer. Well, Brett, thank you very much for talking to us.
Absolutely.
And thanks for letting me and Dan write in your book. I had a blast. I know I always felt bad, like every time you'd post something on the Facebook page about it, like these are the games that are less, but like I could write about all these games, but I don't want to like force myself on this guy. Like I don't want to fill up the book.
Right. Well, the enthusiasm really shows through in these stories, and you can tell that the contributors were really, it's funny. I posted this on a certain message board about, you know, I was soliciting stories and that, you know, this isn't, there's no compensation involved, but, you know, you will get your stories published in a professionally published book that's going to be in bookstores and all this good stuff. Well, man, I got some, you know, trolls just saying, oh, you know, you're making people work for free, blah, blah, blah. The people contributing the stories are doing it because they love these games and want to share, you know, I would love to be able to afford to pay 79 people, you know, to write about hundreds of games, but it's just not in the cards. Yeah. But at the same time, that's not kind of not what these are about. These are just stories from, you know, people's, this is like their diary or like something they're excited to write about, something they want to write about. So payment wasn't really the issue with this. You know, it was things people are excited to write about, you know, and that really wanted to see their work in print and have their stories told and all that stuff, and to preserve, you know, the history of that era.
And just to really, to be as an aspiring author myself, like it's just super cool to be in that company, you know, like seeing the other people that are like, my words are going to be on the same pages as, you know, like Greg Stewart. I had a ton of respect for him. I loved EGM back in the day. And
awesome.
It's just really kind of an honor to be on the same pages as all these other really important figures in gaming, current and history. And I mean,
yeah, there's a Blue Sky Ranger from Intellivision. I'm having a brain fart right now. I can't remember the name, but yeah, a guy that program for Intellivision contributed some stories too. So I'm really excited about that. And
that's awesome.
But actually, so SNES, the full title of the first book, it's The SNES Omnibus, The Super Nintendo and Its Games, Volume 1, 8th M. That's actually available for pre-order right now, if you don't mind me plugging it real quick.
No, not at all.
Away, man.
Yeah,
okay, cool.
I'll put the link to it in the show notes, too.
Okay, great. Yeah, it's just brettweisswords.com, BrettWeissWords.com. You can pre-order it directly from me. It's not going to be out till summer at the latest, but it's probably going to be spring. But if you order it ahead of time, you get some bonuses. Like I'll autograph it and you get your name in volume 2 as a patron, excuse me. I'll send you a digital copy of one of my older books, the Retro Pop Culture A to Z book. I'll throw in one of my signed Twin Galaxies trading cards. And one out of every 10 people chosen at random who pre-order the book directly from me will get a free download code for a digital copy of a game. So I'll throw your name in a hat, you know, I'll do a random number generator. So one out of every 10 person that pre-orders the book. So if you just get on there, brettweisswords.com, and pre-order the book, you'll get some bonuses in addition to the book itself when it comes out.
Outstanding.
Oh, one more thing real quick. My latest book is actually a book of short stories. It's called The Arcade and Other Strange Tales. It's a collection of short stories that I wrote during the 90s when I was writing all that fiction. But I've updated them, polished them up, and for publication in a soft cover physical book. And the lead story, The Arcade, is over 7,000 words. It actually takes place in a vintage arcade. So I think all my video game readers will get a kick out of that. And then it's got science fiction and horror stories, too. So might check that out as well.
That all sounds awesome. I'll make sure there's a link to all that business in the show notes.
Very cool. I appreciate it.
Of course. All right. Well, that's our show. Join us next week as we continue our Creators Month with a visit from a return visit, actually, from Square Painter and Tiny Ninja. We'll be talking about their upcoming projects, the state of retro game collecting, and more, so don't miss it. Once again, you can get in touch with us at mail@geekade.com, as well as all flavors of social media that we inhabit. You can like us on Facebook, find us on Instagram at Geekade, subscribe to our YouTube and Twitch channels for all our latest video content, and follow us on Twitter at @_Geekade. You can also find us individually on Twitter. I'm at Geekade Chris, that's Geekade K-R-I-S, and Dan is at?
At Geekade Dan.
Brett, are you on the Twitters?
Yeah, it's at Brett Weiss, CHVG.
All right. If you're interested in more information about anything we discussed here tonight, be sure to check out our show notes. And while you're at it, you can also subscribe to this and any of our other wonderful podcasts on iTunes or Stitcher. Or if you're super nice, you can leave us a review, because any and all feedback is welcome and appreciated. We'd also like to thank Evan.
I think we already tanked.
See, this is why we don't get paid for this.
Exactly. So we'd like to thank our intrepid editor, Evan, for making our show listenable for all you folks. And we'd also like to thank Mark TDK Knight for our show's theme. You can check him out on SoundCloud and Bandcamp, or his website, which we'll also have a link to in the show notes. Again, always remember to keep your eyes on Geekade.com for more fresh original content. And that's it, everybody. On behalf of Dan and our guest, Brett, keep playing games.
You guys want some stingers? I could probably supply with some stingers, some grade A stingers. Let's get those going. Here's to you guys. Enjoy.
Thanks, Matt. When we're done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just need to send Matt a message to tell him to stop recording.
Okay.
Yeah. So show notes. That's kind of important.
That's my dog. That's what he's doing while I'm trying to record. It's like, hey, play with me. I'm fucking adorable.
To be fair, he is adorable.
He really
Anytime
is.
You get on the phone or anything like that, you know the kids and pets are going to come around and want attention.
Yeah, they really
That's why
do.
I only record podcasts when the kids are in bed.
There you go.
And the pets have been put to sleep.
Put to sleep.
Yikes. How many pets do you go through, Dan?
We're very hardcore here.
This is episode 187, Dan.
Well, 186, Chris.
Bitch.
There was one day where I missed heaven. The all rabbits right, Dan, are still you, alive,
are you,
though. But
are you recording yet, Dan?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Shall we clap for Dean?
Oh, sure. Count it down.
One, two, three. Sure, why not?
I think counting down would have been 3, 2, 1, but let's...
You tell Brett. See, this is the kind of bullshit I have to put up with on a weekly basis.
We did a charity event last year. We do it every year called the Pain in the Assathon, where we play like super difficult games for 24 hours straight.
I've heard of that.
Funny. Well, Ferg joined us last year, and Ferg and I played what the hell's that game called? Sneak and Peek for 2600.
That's hilarious.
Oh God, it was so brutal. But he showed up.
That's basically the hide and seek game on the Atari, right?
Yeah, I hadn't played it before, and we're playing it, and you walk around and you press a button to hide, and you can like sink into the floor to hide. It's so right. Disturbing. Okay, it was so weird. But he showed up with a bunch of cookies and some challah bread that he made. And it was like, holy crap, this stuff's nice. Good.
Sounds like somebody you'd want to date or something.
Yeah, he really is. Not going to lie. And like that right my there, wife would be that? Cool with that.
Dean, that's an outtake right there. You put that in the show. Because I know Ferg listens to this show, so I want him to know this. Dan and I would date you, Ferg.
That's right. Hard. We'd date you hard.